for policymakers when they're thinking about taking on a new commitment, you know, ask themselves, if you would not send Americans to fight and die for that country today, don't promise to do that in the future.
Welcome back to the Hopkins Podcast on Foreign Affairs, the entirely student-run podcast at Johns Hopkins University. I'm your host, Julia Ahn. Realism has been the dominant theory of international relations since its conception, and within the realist school, the balance of power theory is a core tenet and posits that in order to survive as independent entities in an anarchic system, states are compelled to increase their power and balance against a potential hegemon. This theory was modified by Stephen Walt in 1985, who emphasized the role played by threat perceptions rather than power itself to explain why states don't always balance against rising powers. In this episode, Professor Walt and I discuss the key tenets of his balance of threat theory, including how its implications are distinct from balance of power theory. We also discuss the application of the theory to the war in Ukraine, from the events and key decisions leading up to the conflict to how a lasting peace can potentially be negotiated. Professor Walt is the Robert and Renee Belfer Professor of International Affairs at the Harvard Kennedy School, serves on the editorial board of Foreign Policy, and is a fellow of the American Academy of Arts and Sciences. We hope you enjoy this episode of the Hopkins Podcast on Foreign Affairs. Professor Wall, thank you so much for joining me today on the podcast.
It's my pleasure.
To start us off, could you give our listeners an overview of the key tenets of your balance of threat theory? What criteria do states consider when they're evaluating the threat that's posed by another state?
I'm glad to. So in anarchy, I mean, the theory begins, like most realist theories, with the recognition that in anarchy, states care first and foremost about their security, which means they're always concerned with identifying threats and responding to them. Threats in the theory are a function of four different components: the aggregate power of potential adversaries, how strong they are, their geographic proximity. A strong state nearby is more dangerous than one that's far away. Their specific military capabilities. Do they have the capacity to project power against you, maybe even conquer you? Offensive capabilities. And lastly, perceived intentions. Do they appear to be highly revisionist? They want to change the status quo. They want to take over part of your country, etc. And I argued that those four components made up a threat, and states would generally respond to those threats by either greater internal effort or by seeking allies who had similar concerns and forming alliances to counter the threat.
And a subtle but important aspect of this theory then is the separation between power from threat in these calculations. So how does this change and its implications add to the realism school, and in particular to Kenneth Waltz's famous balance of power theory?
Right. Well, Ken Waltz was my advisor and obviously had a huge influence on me. Mm-hmm. But I thought balance of threat theory improved on his very structural theory that focused on power because it simply allowed us to explain some anomalies. If you looked at the two big alliances in the world during the Cold War, for example, the U.S.-led alliance was vastly more powerful than the Soviet Union. The United States had most of the world's major industrial powers on our side. We outspent them collectively in military terms every year. We had a larger population, unless you counted China, which was relatively weak in those days. And so by most of the indicators of power, this wasn't a balanced world at all. It was quite imbalanced as well. And I thought by including these other factors, you could account for that anomaly. It also accounts for other anomalies subsequently. Think of the first Gulf War, for example. Mm-hmm. Iraq was vastly weaker than the coalition that ultimately formed to throw Iraq out of Kuwait. But that large coalition formed because Iraq seemed particularly threatening, partly due to its location and partly due to the intentions that they had revealed by seizing Kuwait. So I felt that balance of threat theory actually did a better job of responding to how states really measure threats and respond to them.
And I know when you set up your balance of threats theory, you made an emphasis about the different hypotheses underlying balancing versus bandwagoning. Now, knowing that there are different forms of balancing that can arise, you know, from alliances to building up military, is there a way to categorize these types of balancing?
Well, states can balance in lots of different ways. I mean, the core distinction, and this is in Waltz, is between internal and external balancing. Internal being mobilizing your own national resources to increase your military capabilities or, you know, make yourself more secure. And that's obviously something states do constantly. External balancing is the formation of alliances, and that's primarily what I was focused on. You could add other things as well. You can try to improve the balance by undermining an adversary in different ways as well. But in general, realists have all argued that balancing is more common than bandwagoning for the simple reason that you can't trust the powerful. So if you align with a powerful state, you're hoping that they won't try to come after you later. You have to trust in their continued benevolence. And balancing, as Waltz argued, and I echoed him, was the safer course, was to try to make sure that no country became so powerful that it could impose its will upon you. And that meant you would join the weaker side or the less threatening side going forward. Subsequently, people like John Mearsheimer emphasized that there was a third approach here, neither balancing nor bandwagoning, what he calls buck passing, something that Waltz also talked about. And that's basically where you try to get someone else to deal with a threat problem while you stay out of it. That's obviously the best way to deal with a potential threat, but that has risks involved, because if the people you pass the buck to don't do a good job of stopping a potential aggressor, then you have to do it perhaps in less favorable conditions.
And to set up our discussion later on foreign policy in Ukraine and China, I wanted to also ask you what you see as the key differences between the realist school of thought and liberalism, which has been so important in American thought for the past few decades. And has there been anything to learn from liberalism that can be applied now to the realist tradition?
The second part of your question is a harder one. It's a great question. And I guess I will come back to that at the end. I mean, there is a fundamental divide between realist and liberal theories of international politics, and one should recognize that there are different strands of thought within these two traditions. Realist school, you know, emphasizes anarchy, the lack of a central authority in world politics, the priority of power, that power tends to determine things, that rules exist, but they are primarily set by the powerful and violated by the powerful when necessary. Emphasis on relative gains, that states are always concerned with how the balance of power may be shifting, and you're not going to be able to eliminate these problems entirely. I think that's sort of the general. So realism's a pretty gloomy school of thought here. Liberalism starts out very differently. Liberal theories, almost of all kinds, begin with this idea that all individuals, all human beings, have certain inalienable rights that have to be protected, and that the only legitimate governments are those that respect those rights as well. And this is a universalist view, right, that this principle applies everywhere there are human beings. It applies around the world. And liberals, therefore, focus not so much on power, but rather on the internal characteristics of states. Are you a legitimate government, by which liberals usually mean a democratic government, a liberal democracy, or you are an autocracy, a fundamentally illegitimate, you know, rule of force kind of state? So liberals tend to divide the world into the good states that follow liberal principles and everybody else. And it's everybody else that they see as the source of the problems in the world. If you could just create a world that was all liberal democracies, everything would be fine, which unfortunately means that liberals tend to have a crusader impulse, right? If you see a bad state somewhere, a state that's not respecting rights, that's an autocracy, that isn't a democracy, you ought to try to do something about it. You ought to try to convert that into a democracy, and then all will be well. And unfortunately, that occasionally, or maybe more than occasionally, leads powerful liberal states to go off on ill-advised adventures. And often in doing so, then violating some of the principles that they claim to uphold. These are pretty fundamentally different things. I think what realists can learn from liberalism, and you see this in the writings of some realists, like, especially Hans Morgenthau, is that, first of all, moral judgment is never completely absent. States do horrible things all the time, but there's also a desire, a pretty common desire throughout humanity, to act in a more moral fashion or to bring those under some constraints. And I think also realists have come to appreciate more the importance of rules and institutions. Realists tend to see those rules as necessary, as tools that states have to have in order to manage their relationships. And realists would emphasize that, you know, again, rules are set by the powerful. But I think if you look at the evolution of realist thought, we've gained sort of a more respect for the importance of rules and institutions, in part because of some of the writings that came out of prominent liberal theorists.
I see. And like you said, we see a lot of the liberalism in American foreign policy in perhaps some of the interventions that were done on a very moral basis. But I wonder, in the realist school of thought, is there a place for the United States as a leader in international affairs, as making some of the more important decisions in the way or the direction that international affairs go?
No question. I mean, the United States is still the most powerful country in the world, and what it chooses to do or what it chooses not to do will have a tremendous impact. So mm-hmm. the United States has, I think, in various points in its history, had played a very constructive role. And during the Cold War, the United States was critical to maintaining some degree of stability in Europe and also to some degree in Asia as well. I think we played a central role in setting up the principal institutions by which the world economy, at least the capitalist world economy, was run. And I think largely for the benefit of most of the people engaged in that, again, not to say it was perfect. So there are lots of ways in which the United States, I think, can play a positive role. I think, unfortunately, there are mistakes that we will make as well. And when you're as powerful as the United States is, those mistakes tend to have real consequences for people in other parts of the world. And, you know, again, just speaking for myself, I think we are often not adequately self-reflective about how the things we have done, often with the best of intentions, have ultimately produced quite dangerous outcomes for others and also for us.
And I think that's a great segue to talking a little about Russia's invasion of Ukraine. I know there's been a lot of discourse and discussion about analyzing what really led up to that. So I wanted to ask you, was Russia's invasion of Ukraine, and even before that, the annexation of Crimea, do you think that's a reaction to the growing threat of an expanding NATO alliance?
Yes, but one must be very careful about the language here. I think the evidence is overwhelming that the Russian first annexation of Crimea and then subsequent illegal invasion of Ukraine, was a reaction to the threat they perceived from the expansion of NATO and then the attempt to start bringing Ukraine into Western security institutions, making it a central part of the Western alliance system. Now, whether or not that was a genuine threat, that is to say, you know, what you will get from the people in the West is, of course, NATO was no threat to Russia. We didn't intend ever to harm Russia. It's fanciful to believe that we would ever do anything harmful to Russia. That's kind of irrelevant because Russia saw it as a threat. They made it clear for years that they saw it as a threat. And it's not all that surprising that they would see it as a threat. Right? Great powers are always pretty sensitive about what's happening in or around their borders. And this is the world's most powerful alliance, steadily moving forward at a moment, by the way, where the United States and others are declaring that a central part of our foreign policy is to try and spread democracy as we define it, as far as possible in as many places as we possibly can. And we had done that in Eastern Europe. We had done that in, tried to do that in various ways in Ukraine as well. So it's not fanciful that Russia saw this as dangerous. They made it very clear. And Ukraine was a particular point of concern for them. The U.S. government officials had recognized this and had warned that attempts to bring Ukraine into NATO or into the West was, as former ambassador to Russia Bill Burns famously put it in a 2008 memorandum, this is the brightest of all red lines for the Russian political elite. And he was very clear at saying it wasn't just what he called the knuckle draggers in the Kremlin. He said this is true even of Putin's sharpest liberal critics across the political spectrum. Inclusion of Ukraine into NATO was the brightest of all red lines. And that warning, unfortunately, was not heeded by us.
Right. And looking through this lens of realism and balance of threat, I know you just mentioned the statement to eventually include Ukraine into NATO. What were some other maybe key missteps of NATO then, looking through this lens, that led up to 2014 and then now the invasion of Ukraine?
That's also a great question, because it was certainly not just things from 2008. I think if you step back and look at how the United States handled Russia, really from the collapse of the Soviet Union forward, we treated them with a certain degree of contempt. I mean, there were some modest efforts to collaborate and cooperate, particularly in the 1990s, setting up, a NATO-Russia council and things like that. But we abandoned the Partnership for Peace, the original idea for a post-Cold War security architecture, which was unfortunate because the Partnership for Peace would have been open to Russia. Right? Russia was never given an opportunity to join NATO, but it could have been involved in Partnership for Peace. I think that was a better approach going forward. I actually believe the first wave of NATO expansion, Poland, Hungary, and the Czech Republic, that the Russians would have tolerated that. They were too weak to do much about it. And if it had stopped there, we might have been okay. But then there were other steps. The Bush administration abandoned the ABM Treaty, which was one of the cornerstones of U.S.-Russian cooperation. Excuse me, going back to the Cold War days. And then when NATO members decided to intervene in Libya, when the Arab Spring hit Libya, Russia actually abstained in the Security Council and therefore did not prevent that operation from happening, because it was intended to be purely a humanitarian operation. And instead, eventually, the mission creep set in, and the United States, France, Great Britain actively aided the overthrow of Gaddafi. And the former Secretary of Defense, Robert Gates, said later that, the Russians thought we'd played them for suckers, right? Got them to go along with this, and then we changed the mission on them. So I think there was a steady series of events that have poisoned the relationship between the United States and, you could argue, the West and Russia over many years. And then from, 2014, when the Maidan uprising happened, and the United States, in the wake of Maidan, beginning to arm and train Ukrainian forces, all of this eventually led Putin to the conclusion that he had no choice but to do this. That doesn't justify what he's done, but it does, I think, help us understand it.
And I think this perspective is certainly in contrast to what I see a lot of commentators arguing, which is that Russia's actions actually had nothing to do with NATO enlargement, but it simply, from, I guess, 1991, was not content to live within those borders. So how would you respond to those who say that, you know, based on Russia's actions, it was actually right for the U.S. and its allies to balance against an aggressive Russian threat, especially by taking the Ukraine NATO membership more seriously?
Well, first of all, I think many of the people who are trying to claim that our actions had nothing to do with this are essentially trying to evade responsibility. I mean, these were the people who for years argued that the way to preserve peace in Europe was to keep expanding NATO. They are the architects of these policies, which eventually unintentionally led to a tragic war. And so to claim that NATO expansion had nothing to do with it is a way of letting themselves off the hook. No, and the second point to make is that Russia's actions were not particularly aggressive. They had engaged in, you know, some frozen conflicts on the periphery, but there was no evidence that they were preparing to invade or reincorporate parts of the former Soviet Union, that they intended to attack the Baltic states, etc. The actions they've taken in the last 2 years are far in excess of any of the steps that Russia had taken, despite the fact that, you know, we kept moving NATO eastward and made it clear that our NATO enlargement was an open-ended process, right? That this was also part of it, that, you know, that we didn't draw the line anywhere. As if states qualified for NATO membership and wanted to join, we would let them in. And I think that was very difficult, you know, for Russia to accept as a acceptable status quo. You know, it's a status quo in which the line is always moving in our favor. And here, by the way, an important realist concept comes in, which is the idea of the security dilemma. Right, that you could say, well, you know, what this has shown is we should have let these countries in even sooner. And the problem is that actions we take that we think will make us more secure will often make others less secure. And of course, that works in reverse. Things they do to try and enhance their security make us feel less secure. I think the people who were cautioning all along about NATO enlargement understood the security dilemma. Understood that, in fact, in order to have stable peace in Europe, all of the countries in Europe, and this would include Russia, have to feel reasonably safe. And we were taking steps that was only making one side safe without realizing that the other had options and might eventually react, as ultimately and tragically they did.
Right. And although, I guess, Putin's perhaps view of what NATO expansion meant might have been rational, but of course the illegal invasion was not. Did Putin make any other miscalculations or misunderstandings also from a realist perspective in the lead up to the invasion, but also throughout the course of the war so far?
Yeah. So I think Putin got some things very badly wrong, and he also got some things right. you know, this is more apparent in the fullness of time. Well, he clearly, I think, underestimated Europe's willingness to balance. The Swedish and Finnish decisions, the rapidity with which Germany weaned itself off of Russian oil and gas, the beginnings of, I don't want to say remilitarization, the beginnings of increased defense preparations in Europe, et cetera. I think he didn't expect most of that to happen. I don't think he expected the sanctions that were imposed to be as far-reaching as they were. And I think he clearly overestimated the capabilities of the Russian military in the initial phase of the war. And last but not least, I think he underestimated the ferocity and heroism of the Ukrainians in defending their country. So all of those things are miscalculations, which means instead of a short special military operation, he ends up with a long and expensive war. So he made those mistakes. He did get a few things right. One, that the sanctions, although painful, would be bearable and that it wouldn't crash the Russian economy. I think he was correct that the Russian military could was resilient and would improve over time if it was a long war, and that's been borne out as well. I think he was also correct that that the invasion would not face universal condemnation. It's been condemned, obviously, in the United States, in Europe, and in many other parts of the world, but not everywhere, and that other countries would follow their own interests and would continue to buy Russian oil and gas, would collaborate on keeping the price of oil and gas high, as Saudi Arabia has done, would continue to purchase other things like weapons from Russia as well. So he didn't get everything wrong. And one of the reasons we're in now a long, protracted, and very painful stalemate is that his mistakes at the beginning of the war, which helped bring it about, were not fatal ones.
And now, knowing that both sides made miscalculations and misperceptions, I just wanted to ask you, especially since realist theories tend to portray states more as rational actors, what place, if any, do miscalculation and misperception have in realism?
Well, there's actually some really interesting recent writing on this. John Mearsheimer and Sebastian Rosato have a new book out, How States Think, basically arguing that states are actually mostly quite rational. And what they emphasize is the role of uncertainty, that states actually work very hard in most circumstances to try and make intelligent, thoughtful, successful decisions, but they're doing this in a condition of radical uncertainty. There's just lots of things we can't know. You can't be entirely confident that your military will perform as expected. You can't be entirely sure how an adversary will react. You don't know in advance how third parties might respond to different changes. And the further out you look, the harder it is to see. So states are trying to figure out what to do and do the thing that's most in their interest, but that's inherently hard to do. And I think realism can accommodate the world of uncertainty pretty easily. You could even argue that it's rather central to much of realist theory, because one of the reasons realists say security is so precarious and so difficult to construct and maintain is the difficulty of gauging what others might do in the future, the inability to know exactly how the balance of power is going to shift. So in 1980, 89 or so, people thought, you know, Japan was going to emerge as the next great superpower. And people would write books with titles like Japan is number one. This was just before the Japanese economy crashed and, you know, 20 years of stagnation set in. A few years ago, people thought China was, you know, just going to keep growing at a breakneck pace forever and eventually blow past the United States and suddenly become the dominant world power. That's looking a little bit less clear right now with the Chinese economy and some real trouble, facing real demographic problems as well. All of this is to say that realists, I think, are very mindful of the fact that it is an uncertain world where security can sometimes change very quickly, and therefore one has to be sort of careful and prudent and watchful and try to avoid the both the sins of complacency, but also the sin of hubris, of thinking that everything's going your way and therefore you can accomplish whatever you want.
Now, since the wars began, a key policy position has been to support Ukraine wholeheartedly, with the belief that the outcome of the war would profoundly impact the future of, you know, the future of the international order. And while some have pointed out a moral case for pursuing peace and the saving of lives without an all-out victory, is there a strategic case for doing so as well? And how should we approach this without encouraging future blackmailing and illegal invasions from Russia and even other countries?
Well, on the last point, one of the things you would say is that I don't think the Russian experience in Ukraine is going to encourage a lot of people to do something similar. First of all, there's no evidence that they got away with blackmail. Blackmail is when you threaten someone to do something to someone and get them to do your bidding without actually having to implement the threat. This invasion is going to have really negative long-term consequences for Russia. that I think are significant. Whether Russians look back on it as a big success, this is not the kind of thing that I think is going to tempt other countries to say, oh, look, I want to get into a massively costly 2-year war in which many people die. And, you know, I'm considered a pariah in some circles as well. I think the strategic argument for peace in Ukraine is simply that we have other challenges in other parts of the world. And one of the central problems facing at least the United States is this problem of bandwidth. Right, that we're trying to manage so many problems around the world at once. Ukraine, there's the concerns about China and Asia and Taiwan. We now have an enormous crisis brewing or evident underway in the Middle East that's taking up time and attention. There's the problem of migration on America's southern border, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So the strategic case for conflict resolution in Ukraine is simply that we have other problems to deal with. And if you don't think continuing the war is going to produce a better outcome, a substantially better outcome, if we really are in a stalemate situation where Russia can't conquer Ukraine and Ukraine can't regain the territory it's lost, then as long as this is sitting there and festering and consuming time, attention, and resources, and I might add Ukrainian lives, then it's doing all those things, but to no ultimate strategic benefit. And we'd be better off, and Ukraine might be better off, if we can bring this to a close as quickly as possible, unless you have some magical solution that is going to lead to a substantially better outcome. And I can't see one from where I sit now.
So I suppose you would say that now would be such a time. And if not, I also wanted to ask, what signs should policymakers and, you know, the American public look for in trying to understand when would be such a time where we could know with some level of certainty that more gains could not be made?
Well, I think the results of the Ukrainian counteroffensive are a real indication that there are limits, really clear limits to what Ukraine is able to do. It's partly because there's an overall power and population disparity. You know, Russia has 3 times the population, more innate, latent military potential. They are now mobilizing. So the balance of power looks like it's shifting against Ukraine, and there's limits to what Ukraine's supporters can do unless they get directly involved, you know, sending their own troops as well. And I don't think anyone outside Ukraine is proposing to do that as well. So this is the moment to do that. But be very clear, negotiating even an armistice, but certainly any kind of real peace settlement, is going to be very, very difficult to do. And we will not get everything we want in that. It will be a painful negotiation where, you know, both Ukraine and its supporters are going to have to accept certain things that they don't want. Now, one would like a situation where Russia also has to accept some things it might not have wanted on its ultimate wish list. But for this agreement, whenever it is reached, to last, it has to be an agreement that both sides are willing to live with as better than a resumption of the fighting. And that's going to be an immense task that nobody should underestimate.
Right. And I suppose what Russia would probably ask for is a guarantee against Ukraine accession into NATO. Now, what would you say we should ask for in return, such that, you know, the American people would feel comfortable that this would not be such a strong concession that it would make Russia's illegal invasion worthwhile for them?
Well, there's a whole series of issues involving, you know, repatriation of prisoners and things like that. I think Ukraine would want certain assurances about, you know, navigation in the Black Sea so that they can be free to export, you know, grain and other goods without fear of interference. I think whatever the agreement is has to be ratified by others. So one model would be, you know, whenever an agreement is reached, it is then ratified by a vote of the entire UN Security Council, including China, the United States, and others. So if either side begins to violate the agreement, they are violating international law, because UN Security Council resolutions have the binding effect of international law. And then finally, and this is very important and very tricky, Both sides are going to want assurances for their own future security. So you mentioned, you know, Russia is likely to insist that Ukraine declare itself a neutral state that will not join NATO. Okay, fine. But Ukraine has to be sovereign and secure as well. So what is Ukraine permitted to do in order to feel safe? Is it permitted, if it's not a NATO member, is it permitted to buy weaponry from NATO countries? If it does buy weaponry from NATO countries, can it accept a training mission to help them learn how to use the weapons? And, you know, Ukraine is going to want to make sure that it has the capacity to defend itself in the future. And that's one of those issues that it seems to me that the diplomats are going to have to bargain very hard over, because you can't leave Ukraine in a position where it is permanently vulnerable. And that, you know, 5 years down the road, Russia could decide to resume the war. I don't think, I could be wrong about this, I do not believe Vladimir Putin wants to reabsorb all of Ukraine. I think he understands that trying to govern the entire country would not be a net benefit to Russia. But he may want it to be so weak and so vulnerable that it just does his bidding. And I completely understand that that Ukrainians would reject that. So, again, even if you got to a point where both sides wanted to lay down their arms and stop the killing, you have a lot of issues that are going to have to be resolved to create a stable peace that each side will live with.
And you've written previously about the problem of free riding in our alliances in the case of NATO, but also in our alliances in Asia. What approach can the U.S. take to mitigate this problem whilst still not be seen as potentially abandoning those alliances? And does mitigating this issue and potentially asking our allies to put more into the alliances also necessarily mean a lessening of U.S. leadership and voice in those alliances and areas?
Yeah, I don't think that, I mean, I've thought a lot about this, and I don't think there's a magic formula here. For the burden sharing problem. I mean, this has been an issue with America's alliances, you know, ever since NATO was formed and we started forming bilateral treaties with partners in Asia. You know, the United States is substantially stronger than these countries. And as the theory of collective goods tells us, if there's a disparity in capability, the more powerful tend to end up with a disproportionate share of the burdens. All right, the weaker states can free ride or cheap ride because they know the other side will pick up the stronger power will pick up a lot of the slack. There's no magic formula for getting around that. I think it requires constant attention, constant sort of discussion with our allies, where we make it clear to them that there are limits to our support, and we make it clear to them that if they are not pulling their weight, if it appears that they care less about their security than we do, that makes it very hard for Americans to continue to commit to support them. But there is a domestic political problem here as well. And I think at various points in, say, the history of NATO, we were able to make a lot of progress on that and get greater European contributions. I think in Asia, the same is true. You do see countries in Asia now balancing more vigorously. Japan announcing, you know, its defense budget will double by 2027, which is a really quite remarkable step as well. But there's a kind of, I don't think there's any, you know, sort of clever policy step that magically solves this problem. I think it's just one of those things where you do a lot of diplomatic gardening and make it clear that yes, you're with them, but not if they're not also willing to help.
And would seeing in the future these countries, quote unquote, picking up more of the slack, would that also mean a lessening of U.S. voice and leadership and say in those areas as well?
Well, yes, that is, I think, concomitant. And one of the reasons you've had, you know, free riding in the past is partly because Americans, at least American leaders, were willing to sort of take on a disproportionate share of the burden if they got to run the show. Right. So I think this was especially true in NATO, that we were willing to tolerate European weakness after, particularly after the Cold War, because it put us in a position to sort of drive policy. If if we were to adopt a policy where we went from being Europe's first responder to being Europe's ally of last resort, right? So if, you know, if a major war really does break out and European countries are directly threatened, then we're in. But the rest of the time, we're expecting them to defend themselves. We're no longer the first responder. I think that what comes along with that is the fact that the Europeans will, on certain issues, chart their own course. We will not have as loud a voice in Europe, and we have to accept that. That's going to be part of the deal. And I personally don't think that's a terrible thing. I think our influence in Europe has been a positive thing, but we don't have to run every aspect of it, including every aspect of security policy there. But I think we do have to recognize that if you're successful in getting your allies to bear more of the burden, they're going to listen to you somewhat less than they do now. Fortunately, I think our interests are sufficiently compatible on most issues that that's not going to be a serious problem.
And with alliances becoming all the more important in a multipolar world, and as the U.S. continues to evaluate its current commitments, make new ones, what cautionary words would you have for current policymakers and maybe even future policymakers who are listening to the podcast right now?
I think, first of all, you want to think very long and hard about what are American interests. What are the things that we need to be true about the world in order for American security to be enhanced, in order for American prosperity to be preserved, and in order for Americans to live relatively secure and free lives? What are the parts of the world that matter the most? Where are the places that we have leverage? Where do we have to defend? And where are the things we don't have to be necessarily as engaged by? That comes with a recognition that extending security commitments to other countries, where you have to think about sort of what's the benefits to us and what are the potential costs and risks. The fact that a country is now has been pledged to be protected by the United States may or may not make the United States more secure. So you have to start by thinking about what American interests are. The second cautionary point I'd make is that, you don't write checks on the assumption that they won't be cashed. It's a good way to go bankrupt. I think that just to take the example of NATO enlargement, I think there was a period where people were willing to extend these guarantees on the assumption that we would never actually have to honor them, that merely by extending the guarantee, we would guarantee peace. And therefore, we'd never have to actually fight for these areas because no one would possibly challenge the mighty United States. Deterrence would work everywhere around the world. The more places we could bring into our security umbrella, the more places that would then be peaceful, and you'd never actually have to fight for these places as well. And I think that's always a mistake. So one thing is, for policymakers, when they're thinking about taking on a new commitment, ask themselves, if you would not send Americans to fight and die for that country today, don't promise to do that in the future. Right? And that's not to say the United States should not have alliances and partnerships and prepare to defend a number of places around the world. But ask very clearly, if you're not willing to fight for them now, don't say you're willing to fight for them down the road.
Professor Walt, thank you so much for joining me today for such an informative discussion.
All right, thank you. I really enjoyed it.
Thank you very much for listening to this episode of the Hopkins Podcast on Foreign Affairs. We hope you enjoyed it. We would like to say thank you to the International Studies Program at Johns Hopkins University and the SNF Agora Institute at Johns Hopkins University for making this episode possible. Remember to follow us on social media at HopkinsPOFA on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook for the latest and greatest of Hopkins POFA content. Hit follow on Spotify, subscribe on iTunes, and leave a rating. We'll see you next time.